Alrighty. So the final day, all we're going to do is the slideshow. No, you're already done with lab exercises. And what we're going to talk about today is proteomics. Proteomics is kind of named after genomics. Have you heard the word genomics? In the news, at least. Genomics refers to the study of the genome, which is all of the DNA that occurs in an organism. So the genome includes all the genes. Genomics is the study, therefore, of genes. Figuring out how many genes are there, where they are, what they do, and how they're controlled is genomics. And that's a pretty complicated branch of biology. There's a lot of work that goes into figuring out genes. But what have we said genes are for? What do genes do? Indirectly, they give you your traits. What do they do directly? They code for a messenger RNA molecule, which then codes for a protein. Exactly. So genes are instructions for how to build proteins, right? Therefore, the next step, after you figure out the genes, if you do, is to study the proteins themselves. And that's what proteomics is. And as complex and as huge as genomics is, proteomics is much bigger and much more complicated. And so proteomics is going to keep us busy for quite a while. You know, it's not like we've mastered genomics. There's still a lot to figure out within genomics. But proteomics is the new wave of molecular biology, basically. So this is what's going to keep people busy for the rest of my life. And after I die, I don't care. All right, so it's the study of protein structure and function. To study the structure and function of proteins, you need to work with proteins. You need to have them on hand. And you saw from the last movie how difficult it can be just to find proteins even before you figure out what they do, which is itself a big problem. But an organism's proteome, just like a genome is the entire set of DNA or genes in an organism, the proteome is the entire set of proteins. And that depends on the species. Right? There's no limit to the number of proteins that could be produced. From a design standpoint, you can make whatever protein you want in a laboratory, but an organism can only make a certain set of proteins. And why is that? Right, because that's what the DNA they were given is. So whatever your DNA is, whatever your genome is, determines your proteome. And it's those actual proteins and what they do that directly give you your traits. And that's why I say that DNA only indirectly gives you your traits. DNA gives you your available set of proteins. The proteins themselves give you your traits. All right, slide two. I think I've really pretty much already covered this, but the reason that genomics tells us what kind of proteins an organism can make, has the capacity to make, is because of how genes work, right? Because of the genetic code. So we can look at DNA. If we know what the genes are from genomics, we can figure out what the proteins are that organism can make simply by looking at the codons, looking up in the genetic code what the amino acids are, and therefore we know what the strings of those amino acids, which are the proteins themselves. But just knowing what the proteins are does not at all tell us how they work, what they do under what circumstances, and how they're controlled, things like that. That's all what proteomics is about. And that's, like I said already, a lot more complicated, a problem, a set of problems than genomics is. Now, slide 3 is a table that is an overview of protein functions. And I've talked a little bit about this before when we went through the different kinds of macromolecules. What are the 4 kinds of macromolecules that organisms make? Lipids, polysaccharides, nucleic acids, and proteins. And among those 4, proteins have by far the most diverse set of functions. They can do just about everything, which is why you can choose any function within a cell, and somehow proteins are going to be involved. Proteins do just about all the important work in any cell of any kind of organism. And that's because of their versatility, and their versatility springs from the fact that they have so many different shapes. There's so many different ways to put those 20 amino acids together in long strings and then fold them up into 3 dimensions that a protein can have just about any shape you can imagine. And so all proteins operate based on their shape. The function they have is because of the shape they have. But there's a huge variety of functions as well, and that's the point of this slide. So you have enzymatic proteins, enzymes in other words, proteins that act as catalysts. That's a huge set of your thousands of proteins. Humans have about 20,000 genes, so they make about 20,000 different kinds of proteins. And a huge fraction of those just are enzymes. Enzymes are really important because all of the thousands of chemical reactions that occur in a cell don't happen quickly. They all need their own specific kind of enzyme to speed them up. So that's a lot of what our genes are, instructions for how to make the different kinds of enzymes that allow our cells to work. There are then structural proteins, proteins that are used to make structures, to build the stuff up that we're made of. And there's all kinds of structural proteins. You can see examples. There are storage proteins. Here, storage refers to storage of energy. Now, we usually don't store our energy, our extra energy, too much as protein. What do we store our extra energy as? If we take in more energy than we need as food, what do we store it as? Fat, primarily. And that's because fat has the highest energy density, meaning that for a given amount of fat, it stores more energy than the other kinds of macromolecules. So if we were to store it as carbohydrate or as protein, we would have to weigh a lot more than we do to carry around that much energy. And the more you weigh, the more expensive it is to move around. So it makes sense to store it mostly as fat. But there are some storage proteins in different times of life, especially, like albumin in egg white. That's what egg white is albumin, which is protein for that developing embryo. We also have transport proteins, and transport refers to moving things around, like hemoglobin, for instance. Hemoglobin moves things around, oxygen and carbon dioxide in the blood. But there's also all kinds of other plasma proteins, as they're called, proteins that are part of the liquid part of blood that are moving all kinds of other things around. So things stick to these proteins and get transported around the body that way. A lot of proteins also act as hormones. Hormones are chemical signals that cause things to happen in a cell that wouldn't happen if those signals were not present. Now, not all hormones are proteins, but most of them are. What are the ones that aren't proteins made of? Anyone know? What other kind of macromolecule makes up hormones besides proteins? Lipids, actually. Lipid, the ones that aren't protein-based hormones are derivatives of cholesterol. We make cholesterol into a lot of things, including all of the steroid hormones, like testosterone and estrogen and illegal steroids. Those are all lipid-based hormones. Receptor proteins are proteins that are on the surface of or inside a cell and have a certain shape that can attach to just the certain kind of ligand, which can be either a hormone or anything else. A ligand is just a general word that refers to something that binds to a receptor. So this is how cells communicate, by receptor proteins. And then there are a bunch of contractile and motor proteins. This is how your muscles work, for instance. Muscles pull. That's all they can do. They can't push. All muscles can do is shorten actively on their own. They shorten. Well, they shorten because there's a bunch of protein fibers in your muscles that increase their overlap. And when you increase the overlap between them, the cell gets shorter, and therefore the whole muscle gets shorter. And we've already talked about last time a whole bunch of defensive proteins, which are the antibodies that B cells produce and the antigen receptors that T cells produce. Those are proteins. And the reason that they are so specific and recognize just one kind of antigen is once again because of their shape. All of these functions come from specific shape. All right, now, speaking of shape, slide 4 introduces the 4 levels of protein structure. All proteins have at least 3 levels of structure. Some proteins also have a 4th level. So let me distinguish between the word protein and polypeptide. I can't remember whether I've already done this earlier. But a polypeptide is just a string of amino acids. And some proteins are made up of just one string of amino acids. So in that case, protein and polypeptide would really mean the same thing. But some proteins are more complex. They're made up of multiple polypeptides that are then brought together somehow. Not end to end, because that would just make a longer polypeptide. But the polypeptides remain their own strands, and then those are brought together and linked somehow. All right, so the 4 levels are just named for numbers: primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. First, second, third, and fourth, in other words. And the primary structure of a protein is simply the specific sequence of amino acids. And so you can, without even having the protein on hand, you can tell what the primary structure of a protein is just by looking at the messenger RNA that's produced during transcription. Right? Because all you have to do is read the codons, look up the codons in the genetic code, and that'll tell you the sequence of amino acids. That's what the primary structure is. And the primary structure determines all of the other levels. Because what that sequence is going to determine how this strand folds up, coils up, whatever, into 3 dimensions to give it a specific shape. The secondary structure refers to major kinds of repeating themes within the primary structure. So you get things like beta pleated sheets and alpha helices. You see these occurring over and over within that same long polypeptide, but when it folds up into 3 dimensions, you'll have parts of it that are corkscrew shaped, alpha helices, part of them are accordion shaped, these beta pleated sheets. The tertiary structure refers to the overall 3 dimensional shape of a single polypeptide. And like I said, if it's a protein that only has one polypeptide, then that's as far as it goes. The tertiary structure is the overall 3-dimensional shape of that entire protein in that case. But if we're talking about these proteins that are made of multiple polypeptides, which are called multimeric proteins, then and hemoglobin is a good example of this, then there are multiple polypeptides. Now, they might be identical polypeptides. Hemoglobin, for instance, has four polypeptides that it's made out of, but it's two copies of two types. There's two alpha and two beta pieces. The two alphas are identical to each other, the two betas are identical to each other, but they all remain individual polypeptides. They all have a beginning and an end, and then those four come together to form the overall hemoglobin molecule. In that case, we can talk about quaternary structure. So this applies only to multimeric proteins that have multiple polypeptides. Okay. Slide 5. What we're looking at here is a cell. This represents a cell. And what kind of cell is it? Of the two major kinds of cells, what kind is this? This is a eukaryotic cell. Good. Because it has a nucleus. The lavender thing is the nucleus. All this stuff is the cytoplasm. And we've covered a lot of what's occurring on this slide already. What you see here is gene expression. What are the two major steps of gene expression? Not transgenesis. Transcription first, and then translation. And in a eukaryotic cell, transcription has to occur in the nucleus, because that's where the DNA is. So transcription reads the DNA and makes a messenger RNA, right? That messenger RNA then has to be translated in order for the protein to be made. And that occurs where the ribosomes are, which is out in the cytoplasm. So you see the messenger RNA coming out of the nucleus, going to the cytoplasm, joins up with a ribosome, and then the amino acids, according to the code that's in the messenger RNA, the amino acids are attached to each other one at a time in the correct kinds and in the correct order to make the polypeptide. All right, so that's gene expression. We've talked about that before. The new information here is all the ways in which this process, this overall process of gene expression, can be controlled. So there is, at the top, chromatin modification. What is chromatin? It is the stuff that chromosomes are made of. And what are the two components? DNA and proteins, exactly. So how the chromatin is structured is going to determine whether or not genes are available to be transcribed. Remember I said that not all of your genes are on at all times. For instance, in a certain kind of cell, if in your liver cell, you don't want to have genes that aren't related to liver function be turned on at all. You don't want to have the genes that make the proteins that make up the lens of your eye turned on in a liver cell or any other non-eye cell, right? Those need to be turned off. Well, one way to turn off genes is to modify the chromatin, basically, coil it up tightly in that area so that gene is unavailable. It's like putting it in the back room of a library, so you can't just take it off the shelf. So that's one way of modifying this or controlling this process. That's pre-transcriptional control, because it happens before transcription. There's also, if a gene is allowed to be transcribed, if it's turned on, in other words, then you make a messenger RNA, but that messenger RNA can be modified. So there's post-transcriptional control that a cell can exercise. And part of that in a eukaryotic cell, for instance, is taking out introns and sewing the exons together, like I talked about. That's post-transcriptional control. And by the way, if you just look at the DNA, in other words, if all you care about is genomics, then you're not going to have any way of telling what are the introns and what are the exons, right? That's part of a messenger RNA molecule, past the point where DNA's job is done. So all of this from here onward is part of proteomics. But anyway, there's RNA processing, which is post-transcriptional. You can also control the transport of the messenger RNA to the cytoplasm, because unless it gets out of the nucleus, it's not going to end up making a protein. It's another level of control. Once the messenger RNA does make it to the cytoplasm, then it can be translated. But you still have several places where you can control the process, because a protein, once it is comes off of the assembly line at the ribosome, when it's brand new, in other words, it's not necessarily ready to go to do whatever its job is. So there's post-translational modification as well. You know, maybe some of the amino acids have to be cleaved off to make it the correct protein. Maybe other things besides amino acids need to be attached to it to make it a lipoprotein, for instance, half lipid, half protein. All kinds of modifications can occur. And, well, that'll make an active protein to do whatever job it does. But there's also control exercised to make sure that that protein is doing its job only when it should be doing its job. So you make an active protein, but you can put a switch on it, for instance. So it can be turned on or off depending on whether or not the cell needs it. All right, and that's important because you don't want a protein to keep doing its job after the job is really complete, right? If it's an enzyme, for instance, the reason that you bother making that enzyme is because the chemical reaction that it catalyzes is something that you need to happen. But after you make enough product out of the substrate, you no longer want to keep making product. It's expensive to make stuff that you don't want to make. So you really don't want that enzyme to continue to be there. So you can either turn it off, which is one way of controlling it, or you can degrade it. Proteins don't last forever. They're intentionally digested by the cell, destroyed, so they won't continue working beyond a certain point. And that's no problem to destroy them, because you can always then go back to the library if you need a new one and go through the whole process again. All right, now, slide 6 shows you a specific way in which you can control gene expression. Gene expression, remember, refers to transcription and translation. In this case, what you have is a biochemical pathway represented by this string of orange things. You remember what a biochemical pathway is? What is a pathway? It's multiple chemical reactions, and they're in series, end-to-end arrangement. So whatever the first chemical reaction spits out as a product, that then serves as a reactant in the second one. It gets turned into a product again. That feeds the third reaction, and so on. So each of these arrows represents a reaction turning the thing above it into the thing below it. And then this is going to get turned into this, then this into this. And like I've said several times, just about every individual reaction in a cell requires its own enzyme in order to allow that to happen quickly. So that's why you have, in this example pathway, three different enzymes at work, three different proteins, each doing the job of catalyzing just one step of the pathway. All right? But the whole reason this pathway, from precursor at the top down to tryptophan, which is the final product, the whole reason this pathway is operating in the cell is because, for whatever reason, at the moment, the cell needs tryptophan. Right? So that's why it's operating this entire pathway. But, well, as long as the cell needs the tryptophan, it makes sense to keep making it, right? And as long as it keeps needing it, tryptophan will not build up because it's going to be used continuously. As soon as it comes off the assembly line, it's going to be used. Eventually, though, the need for tryptophan will be met. And if this pathway keeps operating, tryptophan is going to still keep coming off the assembly line. And therefore, since it's no longer being used, tryptophan is going to build up. Right? So in this case, the tryptophan itself, the extra tryptophan that the cell no longer needs, it starts interfering with the process. This purple arrow refers to feedback inhibition, in which case the product of a pathway inhibits one of the enzymes in that pathway. If tryptophan is being used, it won't be available to inhibit. But if it starts building up, which is a sign that there's too much of it, the tryptophan is going to bind to this first enzyme, change its shape so that it no longer works. In other words, it's going to turn enzyme 1 off. And if you turn enzyme 1 off, you no longer can turn the precursor into this stuff. In other words, if you shut down one step of the pathway, since it's a series, you shut down the whole pathway. You can't get to here, you can't get to here. And therefore, you're not going to make any more tryptophan, which is exactly what the cell does not want to do, right? Because it is already enough. So this is feedback inhibition. That's one way of controlling the situation. That's at one level. But it's also possible to interfere with the DNA. Okay, now notice that there's DNA listed right beside this. This is not where it is in the cell. It's just telling you the relationship. Enzyme 1, 2, and 3 are proteins, of course, like all enzymes. And so the cell knows how to make those enzymes because they have the corresponding genes. So there's genes for enzyme 1, for 2, and 3, as you see here. In the case of 1 and 2, it takes actually more than one gene to make that protein. But the point is, there are genes that correspond to enzymes. So yes, you could interfere with the enzyme directly, like you do with this purple arrow. But another way of controlling the process would be to interfere with the transcription of the genes. In other words, quit making that enzyme. That will also turn it off, because enzymes, like all proteins, aren't allowed to hang around forever. They eventually will degrade and stop working. Well, if you stop making new ones, then you shut down the process that way. Okay? This is how cells control biochemical pathways. All right, now slide 7 has a lot of detail to it, and I'm not going to get real deeply into this, but the point of all of this, what looks like confusion, is that cells can really operate pretty tight control of their genes, control of transcription, in other words. I've already said today that genes can be turned on or off. They have to be able to be turned on or off. You don't want to make all possible proteins. So genes need to be able to be turned on and off. This is a way that this can happen. This happens to be in bacteria. So these are prokaryotic cells. Prokaryotic cells have their genes organized in little clusters called operons. So that operon, this is DNA that we're talking about, because that's what genes are, right? This is part of the single chromosome that a prokaryotic cell, like a bacterium, has. And it arranges its genes in little groups because that way it can turn all of them on or all of them off at the same time. And the reason that makes sense is because if it needs any of those genes, it's going to need all of them, because they're all involved in the same kind of process. So it makes sense to turn them on and off as a group. And that's why a single operon with its several different genes will have one place on it called the promoter, which is basically like the control switch. The promoter is where and we've talked about this before, the promoter is where the RNA polymerase is able to recognize that gene, bind to it, and then start transcribing it into messenger RNA. So if the RNA polymerase enzyme, that egg-shaped thing, is not able to bind to the promoter, that gene, or in this case, that set of genes, will stay off, won't be able to be transcribed. So the whole notion of controlling this operon really boils down to having a way to control whether that RNA polymerase molecule is able to bind to that promoter or not. And it does that with various molecules that either block the promoter or unblock it, allow the enzyme to bind there or disallow it from binding. So here you have these molecules called repressors that are operating in that fashion. They're either repressors are named repressors because they will keep the gene off. You also have activators, which turn genes on. But they're basically just control molecules, and they're proteins themselves. So consider the fact that what you're doing here by turning a gene on or off is controlling whether or not a certain kind of protein is made, because that's what genes do, right? Make certain kinds of proteins. To control whether these proteins are made requires other proteins to control the genes. And those proteins, like all proteins, are made under the instructions of genes. So there's genes somewhere else that make these proteins that control these genes and determine whether other proteins are going to be made. And that's part of why proteomics is so complex. Looking at just one protein is difficult enough, but that's just a tiny part of the story, because that protein doesn't exist in isolation in a cell. It's one of many that interact with each other. Figuring that out is really difficult. Well, slide 8 is more of the same. It's just showing you different ways that these operons can be either turned on or turned off. But like I said, I don't want to really get bogged down into specific details. I don't want you to memorize these operons or anything. All right, now in 9, well, in these last two, slide 7 and slide 8, those were operons. And like I said before, those are in bacteria, prokaryotic cells. What we have in slide 9 is a piece of DNA like occurs in us. So this is eukaryotic cells. And eukaryotic cells control their genes as well, of course. But they don't have operons. Eukaryotic cells control their genes more on a one gene by one gene basis rather than clustering them in operons. And remember back, I think I mentioned that if you consider all of your DNA, only a tiny fraction of it, only about 1%, is actually genes. The stuff that occurs between genes, which is also DNA, is non-coding gene or non-coding DNA. That doesn't mean that it's just trash. Some of it might be, you know, it just might be DNA that's collected over the course of evolution. But just because it's non-coding doesn't mean it doesn't do anything. And this picture shows you non-coding DNA actually working, doing the job of controlling the genes themselves. So just like any gene, there's a promoter. That's the place where the RNA polymerase has to bind in order for that gene to be transcribed. And in the case of eukaryotic cells, there are several different proteins, typically, that need to be present and that need to bind to the DNA, either directly at that promoter or somewhere else, in order for the RNA polymerase to be able to bind to the promoter. So it's not just one protein that's acting as a switch. It's possibly several different proteins. And we call these proteins transcription factors. Factor, in general, usually refers to a protein in a cell. So transcription factors are just control proteins that help determine whether or not a gene is going to be turned on. So all of these individual little purple and blue things are different proteins. And unless all of them happen to be present and come together and bind to the DNA at different places, and notice that one of these proteins is having the effect of bending this DNA. All of this light blue stuff is non-coding DNA. but it's non-coding DNA that's still working to be able to come to the situation of having this gene bind. If not all of these factors are present, then it won't have the right shape, and the enzyme won't be able to bind. So it's really kind of like many switches, all of which have to be thrown. If you throw a lot of them, but not all of them, the thing still doesn't get turned on. And by having a lot of switches, that means you can really very exquisitely control this. Because some of them might be present, but it's not the perfect situation until the other ones are added. Then it gets turned on. That's what happens in us, in all eukaryotic organisms. All right, slide 10 uses an example that I just said about 10 minutes ago about liver cells and lens cells. You know, these are two cells within the same organism, one human individual. All the cells in your body have the same DNA. All cells have the complete library of DNA, right? So all cells technically have the capacity to build all of your thousands of kinds of proteins that the DNA allows you to build. But different kinds of cells within the same individual, they build drastically different kinds of proteins. And they never build some that the other cell will build. Liver cells want to build only liver cell proteins. Lens cells want to build only lens cell proteins. So, in a liver cell, once it's determined during development, during the course of development, that this cell is going to be part of the liver and not part of the eye, then, in other words, once it's a liver cell officially, then it's going to permanently turn off the genes that correspond to non-liver jobs, like this crystalline gene. Crystalline gene is a gene that codes for the major protein that makes up the lens of the eye. Liver has no business ever making that protein. So it's going to modify the DNA so that that is turned off for the entire lifetime of that individual. But it'll allow turning on of proteins for the gene for albumin, which is a protein the liver makes. Converse situation for the eye. It's never going to make albumin, turn that off completely. It needs to make crystalline in order to produce the lens, so that one is allowed to be turned on. Now, in slide 11, we look at some post-translational modifications. Remember, I said post-translational modifications refers to anything that occurs to a protein after it's produced by the process of translation. Translation refers really just to the assembly of the polypeptide, the stringing together of amino acids. That occurs at the ribosome. But that does not mean that the job is done. There are these post-translational modifications that can be performed. Phosphorylation, ubiquitination, methylation, acetylation, glycosylation. Now, these are probably unfamiliar words to you, but they all end in -ation, at least. Really what they all refer to is hooking some sort of thing onto a protein that has just been made. Okay, so phosphorylation refers to hooking a phosphate group onto a protein. And this is a major way in which proteins are equipped with switches. To phosphorylate a protein can turn it on, for instance, so that it's in its active state. This is how you would make an enzyme work once it's built. Dephosphorylation takes it off, that would switch it back off. It's not necessarily that way. Sometimes dephosphorylation will turn it on, phosphorylation will turn it off. But in any case, the phosphate group is like a switch. Well, that can be true with using other things besides phosphate. Ubiquitination is just hooking on a polypeptide called ubiquitin, and that's called that because ubiquitous means occurring everywhere. So you see this protein being used over and over in cells, and that's why it got its name. Methylation refers to hooking on a methyl group, which is a carbon and a few hydrogens. Also, you can use that as a switch. Bacteria, for instance, use methylation to protect their own DNA from their own restriction enzymes. Remember when we talked about restriction enzymes? What experiment did we do that involved restriction enzymes? Not a food. That was the GMO exercise. That involved the PCR process. Restriction enzymes we used in the DNA fingerprinting one, right? But remember how I said restriction enzymes were discovered, how they came into being naturally? Bacteria make them in order to protect themselves from viruses, because a virus will inject its DNA, and the restriction enzymes that the bacteria produce will look for little sequences within that viral DNA and cut it. Cut the viral DNA into little pieces so it can't affect the bacterium. Well, those restriction enzymes work on any kind of DNA that has those little sequences, not just viral DNA, which means the bacterium is vulnerable to its own enzyme that'll chop up its own DNA if it's not careful. The reason it's able to protect itself from its own enzymes is because it methylates those little sequences of DNA that the restriction enzyme is specific for, puts methyl groups onto them so that the enzyme won't recognize them. So it's hiding it. And then acetylation is just adding an acetyl group, a different kind of compound. And glycosylation refers to adding small sugar. Glyco means sugar. So these are all just different ways of hooking on something to a protein in order to control whether the protein works or not. I said earlier that all proteins eventually are degraded, so they don't stick around forever. And that's one way of making sure they don't do their job when they're no longer supposed to do their job. But in the short run, it makes sense to equip them with switches, because it's a lot more efficient if you can temporarily switch off a protein without destroying it, and then not long after that switch it back on if it's needed again. If you destroy it, then you're going to have to go through the expense and the time of building it completely brand new again. That takes longer and it takes energy to do that. All right, now on slide 12, we're looking at the use of proteins as signals. Signals are really important because they allow for communication. They allow for things to happen in cells based on certain conditions. Things will happen if the condition is met. They won't happen if the condition is not met. So the conditions really boil down to whether or not a signal is present. And signals come in different varieties based on how they function. Not based on what they are, really, but on how they function. So, broadly speaking, we have local signaling versus long-distance signaling. Local signaling refers to signals, which are molecules, signals that operate just in a tiny space. Only at that cell or very few cells in the immediate surroundings, not over long distances. So in other words, the signal is produced right where it works. It's not produced somewhere and then sent a long distance to where it actually gets received. And as you see here, local signaling has two major versions. There's paracrine signaling, which is the situation in which a cell called an endocrine cell endocrine cells produce signals and release them, secrete them. So the red particles here are the signal molecules. These are being produced by this cell, and then those signals just diffuse through the fluid that surrounds all cells. They just diffuse based on a gradient, and the cells in the immediate surrounding area might or might not have receptors, which are proteins also, that are just the right shape to receive these signals. If they do have those receptors, then they'll be target cells. This brings up the point that signals don't do anything unless there is a specific kind of receptor that receives the signal. All right, so some cells might be in contact with these signals, but if they don't have the right kind of receptor proteins, they'll just ignore it. They'll ignore the signal. The point here, though, is that what makes these paracrine signals is that the cells that receive them are nearby, but of a different type compared to the cells that make the signal. You also have the situation of autocrine signals, which isn't shown here. But what does auto mean?
Self.
So an autocrine signal would be a signal that's produced by a cell, released from that cell, and then affects cells around it of the same type. That's why it's auto. They work the same way. The distinction is whether or not the cell that makes it and the cell that's affected by it are the same type of cell. In any case, in both of those cases, it's local signaling. In synaptic signaling, which is also local signaling, you have the signal being released from a neuron. A neuron is a nerve cell, and that's what this top one is in this picture. A synapse is a connection between a neuron and some other cell. So the synapse is right here. In synaptic signaling, the neuron releases a signal, and in that case, that specific signal is called a neurotransmitter, which I'm sure you've heard about in the news. Neurotransmitters are signals that are released from neurons and travel just this tiny, tiny short distance through the synapse until they meet with the target cell. They then bind to a receptor and something happens in that target cell that wouldn't happen if the neurotransmitter had not been released. So this is how messages are sent throughout your nervous system. This is how your brain works. Neurotransmitters are released from neurons. That causes the other neurons that they're connected to do something, either fire or not fire. All right, all of that local signaling is different from long-distance signaling just in the distance. In long-distance signaling, what we're talking about is hormones. Hormones operate over a long distance because they are carried by the bloodstream. And blood gets pumped all the way through the body, right? So here you have an endocrine cell, just like you did over here, producing a signal, which we call a hormone. But the difference here is this hormone gets put into the bloodstream and therefore gets broadcast throughout the body because all the cells receive blood, all the living ones do at least. So this hormone is going to go everywhere in the body. But I'm sure you already know that hormones don't have effects everywhere in the body. They can even have the same hormone can have different effects at different parts of the body. Or it can have an effect in one part and no effect at all in a different part. The reason that's true is because, like I said before, nothing happens if there isn't a receptor that can receive the hormone. So you send these hormones throughout the body, but only the kinds of cells that have the right receptors to recognize that hormone are going to be affected by it. That's long-distance signaling. Now, slide 13 is more about signaling. This teardrop-shaped red thing is the signal molecule in this case. And here we have the situation in which the signal, this is a hormone, the signaling molecule, actually it wouldn't have to be a hormone, but let's say it's a hormone. So it's been carried by the bloodstream. Some hormones, like I said earlier, are made of proteins. This one is. The major chemical difference between a protein-based hormone and a steroid hormone, which is lipid-based, is that protein hormones can't get through the phospholipid bilayer that makes up the plasma membrane. So in other words, protein hormones can't get into cells. Lipid hormones, though, have no problem passing right through that membrane. So lipid hormones, like steroids, can go right into the cell. Well, no kind of hormone is going to have any effect on any cell unless there's a receptor. But the point here is that protein-based hormones have to have their receptors situated at the membrane itself, facing the exterior of the cell, because the signal can't get into the cell. So that's what you see happening right here. Signal is binding to the receptor based on shape. And the reason that something happens in the cell that wouldn't happen if the signal weren't there is because a receptor, whenever it binds to a signal, changes shape. So this is like a lock and a key mechanism. But when the key is put into the lock changes shape. That's how the cell knows that the signal is there. If you imagine this shape of this purple receptor molecule changing, that's going to involve the part that's facing the interior of the cell also changing shape. And now it can interact with things in here that it wasn't able to interact with a moment ago before the signal bound to the receptor. So what you see here is a cascade of events. One thing changes another thing based on shape, and the signal is received and it's transduced. So this whole chain of events is called signal transduction. The original signal has done its job as soon as it binds to the receptor. But the whole idea is to cause the cell to have an ultimate response. The ultimate response requires signal transduction. So several changes need to be made, and eventually, at the end of the line, is whatever kind of ultimate response occurs in the cell. And that can be a totally different response in this kind of cell than it would be in a different kind of cell, even though you're using the same exact signal in both cases. Depends on what these intermediate steps are, and that can be different in different kinds of cells. All right, slide 14 has a lot of detail on it too, most of which I'm going to skip, but the point here is that signal transduction can be pretty complex. What we have here are receptors in purple that are able to recognize a specific signal, which is a ligand. Remember, a ligand is anything that can bind to a receptor. So the signal is the red thing. And what's happening here is if the signal molecules are present, then they will bind to the receptor. And because of the shape change, that's going to cause these two receptor pieces to come together. Now they have the right shape to act as an enzyme, and with the help of ATP to provide the energy, pieces of these receptors that are facing interior are phosphorylated. So this brings up what I've already mentioned about modification of proteins. Phosphorylation is happening here. Without these TYR parts, which are just stands for tyrosine, don't worry about what it stands for, without them having the P's on them though, when they're not phosphorylated, they don't do anything in the cell. When they become phosphorylated, which they won't be able to until the two come together in response to the signal, when they do become phosphorylated, though, now all of a sudden they have the right shape to activate other molecules, which might activate still others. That's all part of signal transduction. And eventually, the ultimate goal, whatever that is in this cell, is met. That process occurs. All right, now on 15, this is just a flow chart showing some of the complexity in not only figuring out how proteins work, but in bringing proteins to the market. There's all kinds of proteins, you know, and we don't just do this for the sake of scientific knowledge. That's a big part of it, figuring things out. But proteins are also used widely in industry. It's not just in science. You know, when you hear commercials say that your detergent has certain enzymes in it, blah, 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 for stains or whatever, well, those are proteins that need to be isolated from organisms. And so the process can be pretty tedious and pretty expensive. But you have raw biological material that you can extract these proteins from. Bioreactors are things that you can grow microorganisms in. The microorganisms themselves are making the protein for you, in other words. So you just make conditions perfect for them to multiply, making many, many copies of the proteins. They all come from cells, though, no matter what the source is, they're coming from cells. Cells are the things that make protein. And all sorts of steps are involved in isolating those proteins, because you don't want to just throw an entire mixture of proteins in and hope it contains the one that does the job, right? Just like you saw in the film, in the Cancer Warrior film. They were looking for something they eventually called endostatin out of those thousands of proteins that same kind of cell made. Well, that was a tedious as hell process, because you have to separate all those different proteins based on differences in their properties. But eventually, once you spend enough time and money to do that, you can get proteins for either medicines, for instance, or industrial applications. And some of those these are pharmaceutical applications you see in 16, all kinds of different proteins that are important in medicine. But there's also all kinds of proteins, as in 17, that are important for industrial applications. So we take advantage of the fact, in other words, that enzymes speed up reactions within cells. We take advantage of that fact to speed up similar reactions that we want to have part of an industrial application. You know, in other words, instead of heating something up, which takes energy and money, we can use an enzyme to speed it up for a different reason, if we can make the enzyme cheaply enough. That's just one example, but these are all kinds of industrially important enzymes. And it looks like we're through the material for the semester. So don't forget about the survey. I mean, I can't force you to do the evaluation, but the college likes when they hear about whether a class is good or not, or what's wrong with it, or what's good about it, whatever. So remember, you're evaluating not just me. You are evaluating me, but you're also just evaluating how the course is set up. See you on Wednesday morning, right?